listening to the Air Charter Podcast, the industry's exciting new information and features podcast brought to you by the Air Charter Association. This is the first of our Ask the Expert features, where we have an expert in their field deliver some free advice. So join me for the Air Charter Podcast, brought to you by the Air Charter Association. Thank you for joining me again on the Air Charter Podcast. I'm Kevin Duxbury, and we have an episode that is really going to give you some real added value as we have our first of our Ask the Expert episodes. And we're starting this feature with the subject of charter contracting. I will be joined shortly by the aviation lawyer Jonathan Russell from the law firm Smith, Gambrill and Russell, who will be answering questions that some of our association members have submitted from both charter broking and charter operating companies on the subject of charter contracting. So stay with us to get some really good advice from Jonathan, and of course it's absolutely free, and charter contracts is just one of the many subjects that we'll be covering in our Ask the Expert feature in the future, so please look out for those future episodes. Before we get stuck into those questions on charter contracting, we have some industry news for you. In operator news, Lux Aviation reported an influx of new aircraft to its managed fleet in Europe, with two new additions, a Bombardier Global Express XRS and a Global 5000, bringing the total to 9 jets joining in the past 9 months. Nicholas von Planta, Vice President of Lux Aviation Europe, said that having an average of one aircraft joining the managed fleet every month is testament to the care and expertise shown by the Lux Aviation staff members to each client. The aircraft management service provides all the benefits of ownership without the added hassle of managing operations, giving customers greater efficiencies and lower costs than acting as an individual. In other news, no one would have missed the sad news of the collapse of the airline and tour operator Thomas Cook. Of course, Thomas Cook was a major part of the aviation industry and also provided many charter flights to many customers over the years, including brokers, other tour operators and, of course, other operators. We know that a lot of other airlines and member companies have been providing help and support, and in many cases alternative employment, to many of the thousands of staff members that have sadly lost their jobs in the collapse. And we at the Air Charter Association would like to pass our best wishes to all those staff affected by the loss of Thomas Cook. And we know that the industry will pull together and support all of the dedicated and skilled staff from Thomas Cook, hopefully keeping them in the industry. And if you have any latest news that you wish to read out on our new spot, then please do contact us at admin@theaircharterassociation.aero. Now, before we get into our Ask the Expert feature, let's have a quick message from our sponsor. Since 1995, Western Aviation has been providing the highest level of aviation services across the UK. Now, with 5 locations across England and Ireland, providing full FBO, fuel and ground handling services, Western Aviation has become known as the UK's premium aviation services provider. In addition to their 4 FBO facilities located in Gloucestershire, Humberside, Newquay and Cork, Western Aviation provides specialist cargo handling, trip support services, specialist military handling services and private jet and cargo charters. Whether you're looking to use one of their FBOs or asking them to arrange flight planning support for one of your charter trips, the team at Western Aviation are always on hand to support your aviation needs. Get in touch with them now via their website at www.westernaviation.com. And as a special promotion, if you mention this sponsorship message, you'll receive a 15% discount on any service that Western Aviation provide up to the end of August 2019. This excludes any fuel supply. And just as a reminder, if you would like to sponsor the podcast, then please do get in touch. We have a wide range of sponsorship packages. Please do get in touch at admin@theaircharterassociation.aero. So now to our Ask the Expert feature, and our expert on this occasion is aviation lawyer Jonathan Russell, partner at the firm Smith, Gambrill and Russell. We have been, over the last couple of months, asking members to send in their questions on charter contracting for Jonathan to answer. So now let's get underway answering those questions and giving you some good free advice. You're listening to the Air Charter Podcast, the industry's exciting new information and features podcast brought to you by the Air Charter Association.
Jonathan, really appreciate you giving us the time and, of course, your knowledge on this first Ask the Expert feature. Now, charter contracting is something that we've always had a lot of interest in from our members. And, of course, it's a vital part of the business, both for a broker and, of course, an operator. And it's essential that there's a good understanding of the contracting process and making sure that, obviously, your business is protected and operating with good professional contracts in place. So we have asked our members to submit some questions or any questions that they may have to you. And I know that you will be able to give us some really helpful and valuable advice. But before we dive into those questions, and we do have quite a few to get through, so maybe you can just give us a quick introduction to you and also your company and maybe some of the specialist help that you provide and some of the types of businesses that you've helped on the legal side of the business before.
Absolutely. First of all, I'd just like to say I'm delighted to be involved with this podcast. Hopefully we can bring some colour to some fairly technical bits of law. But in terms of who I am, I'm Jonathan Russell with Smith, Gambrell & Russell. I've been advising aviation clients on a legal basis for 12 years now. I've been with Smith, Gambrell & Russell for 18 months. We're actually relatively new to the UK legal market, but the firm as a whole actually dates back to 1893, and we're headquartered out of Atlanta, and aviation is one of the firm's top practice areas, and we've been widely known in that since the 1920s. We actually have in our aviation group 24 lawyers. We're servicing clients worldwide from offices in the UK, in Southampton and here in London. We have offices in New York, Atlanta, Austin, LA and Miami, as well as a few other locations in the US. We provide legal advice to a range of clients from lessors through to private jet owners, operators. So really a very broad range of clients covering not only transactional work, but also litigation work as well.
Excellent. So, I mean, definitely sounds like we're in very safe hands here when it comes to advice on contracting matters. Now, so thank you for going over that. And we do have some questions, as I mentioned, that have been submitted by our members, and we'll be coming on to those shortly. But first, before I do, I was going to throw some generic questions, if I may, because I know, you know, some of these questions get commonly asked by brokers and operators. So maybe if we can go through some of those first, and maybe kicking off by asking to start with, can you explain the most common contracting position that most brokers legally take?
Sure. And I think before I answer this question directly, it's really important that we set out the laws that govern the principles of agency. These are central to this question and many others that we're going to deal with probably during the course of this podcast. The commercial agents regulations, which implement the commercial agents directive, which apply in England, Wales and Scotland, are applicable to all member states of the European Economic Area as well. That is the 28 EU member states, as well as 3 out of the 4 EFTA countries, which are Norway, Iceland and Liechtenstein. These regulations give commercial agents certain rights that go beyond those implied under the common law of England and Wales. And these include rights to minimum periods of notice and rights to compensation or an indemnity on termination of agency. A considerable amount of UK and EU case law has developed since the directive and regulations were introduced. So to look at common law agency, a common law agent in a strict sense is a person that has the power to create, change or terminate legal relations of another person, i.e. the principal. But the terms agent and agency are often used in less specific senses. In the classic common law agency relationship, the agent has a power to bind and give rights to its principal when dealing with another principal. The relationship is usually established by, say, a consent, either express or implied, and by implied that would be by a course of conduct or dealing. And once the two principals are in a legal relationship with each other, the agent will drop out of the transaction with no further rights or duties to the transaction itself, but obviously with the key residual rights to be able to claim commission on putting the deal together. So a commercial agent with authority to conclude sales on behalf of its principal will fall within this category and will be covered by the regulations we discussed at the outset of this question, and the other criteria for the application of the regulations will also apply. We should also quickly discuss marketing agents who may have the authority to promote the sale of a principal's products and perhaps make representations about characteristics of a product, but don't have authority to conclude binding contracts. So a marketing agent or introduction agent with no authority to conclude sales on a behalf of a principal will fall within this category. So in summary, having drawn that distinction, I think it's fair to say that most brokers are usually contracting as a full common law agent, i.e. they're intending to bind their principal, but then themselves fall away from the transaction once they've put it together.
Okay, so let me understand that a sec. So what you're saying is that in true law, if you like, a broker is obviously an agent, and as that agent, they are putting two parties together away from themselves, given the approval to do that by the customer, I take it, rather than the supplier, is what we're saying, as an agent of the customer.
Yeah.
And then once that contract is in place, technically they're removed from that contracting process in law. Is that right? Did I understand that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So they put the two parties together and they contract with one another.
So, and as you say, with the commission included as part of that process, which is, I presume, sort of agreed and ratified by the customer beforehand, giving the agent the authority to go and do that under the commission structure.
Exactly, yeah.
Right. Okay, great. So I presume that then means that there's obviously some positions where brokers are maybe a little bit further or committed in the chain, or i.e. potentially some of the bigger brokers maybe even acting as the principal, the commercial principal themselves. But just stepping back to the sort of like the agency and middle ground part, as you know, where most brokers probably believe they sit, does that mean that they are totally removed from any commercial or operational liability, or is there any different contract structure where the broker will be seen as totally removed from commercial or operational liabilities?
Well, I think it's important to make sure that whether you're acting as a disclosed or undisclosed principal, so where the third party or where the customer or where the carrier is aware of who the person at each end of the chain is, certainly makes a difference.
Right. Okay. So I think it's obviously then so important the whole structure of these questions is really important for a broker to really understand what their contractual position is in the whole deal and where they actually stand in terms of that, whether they're actually in terms of agency law or principal or whatever. I suppose that's kind of the key message, I suppose.
Exactly, yeah. I think it's very important that a broker understands exactly their role in law, and therefore it doesn't try to, or doesn't sort of unwillingly or knowingly or not, do anything which is beyond their remit, which then they may find themselves in a very different position to that which they thought they were initially.
Great. Okay, excellent. That's brilliant. Thanks very much. Okay, so when it comes to actually signing a contract, obviously a broker understands their position in the contracting process, and they've done the deal, they're coming around to signing the contract, they're going to go, presumably if they're an agent of the customer, they've got the authority to sign the contract. Would they actually be signing the contract, or would that be the customer to sign the contract?
I think if you've got access to the customer who can sign the contract, it always makes sense to ask them to do so. I mean, if you have direct authority to do that, then that obviously changes the picture. But where possible, I think it always makes sense for the two legally contracting parties to sign the agreements themselves.
Okay. I know, obviously, in today's market, probably a majority of brokers are gaining consent to sign contracts on behalf of their customers, from what I understand from the market. But obviously, guys, write in and let us know what you're doing. But in that case, if a broker is signing an operator's contract on behalf of their client, what should they be checking and looking out for before signing that operator contract?
Well, I think that you just really need to check the basics at a very high level to make sure you've checked the price, you've checked the names of the contracting parties, and most of all, that you have the authority to bind the principal, to bind the client.
Okay, so when you say have the authority to bind the client, can you just expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I mean, an agent is basically facilitating contracts between two parties, so between the principal and the third party, or in this case, we say that a passenger. And by introducing the passenger, you're soliciting orders or concluding contracts with third parties on behalf of the principal. So that's the role that we're talking about here.
Okay. All right, that's great. So often when we're dealing with contracts, I mean, in my broker history, I've often heard the term conditions of carriage. And obviously terms and conditions of the carrier. Now, could you explain maybe how they differ? What's the difference between conditions of carriage and, say, from the commercial contract and conditions? Because often they get kind of mixed up or confused, or people think they're the same thing. Could you maybe give us some clarity on that?
Yeah, so a commercial contract and the conditions together form a binding agreement, usually in the form of, say, a passenger ticket, which contains the conditions of carriage, which spell out the obligations and rights of a carrier and a passenger. So in this context, the carrier undertakes to deliver a passenger from, say, a named place of departure to a named destination in consideration for, you know, receipts of money for that journey. Mm. The conditions of carriage deal specifically with what's being carried and how the liability and compensation for damage or injury to a goods or to a passenger are assessed, apportioned, and paid. They also contain a carrier's policy regarding, say, baggage, cancellation, delays, reservations, that kind of thing.
Right. So they're more conditions in terms of the actual carried passenger as opposed to the commercial deal that's put together. And therefore, the passenger or whoever's on board the aircraft knows exactly what the carrier is liable for, which is obviously a different set of liabilities and terms to actually what's been agreed on the actual contract of that charter, if you like. Is that right?
Exactly. Yes.
Great. Excellent. Okay. One final generic question, Jonathan, if you don't mind, then we'll get on to some member questions. And I hate to use this one, as I'm pretty sure we're all fed up with the Brexit question, but how do you think Brexit is going to affect contracts in the aviation industry?
I think that's a really good question. And especially within the relevance of this, the scope of this podcast, it's really really important to understand how the principles of agency may be impacted by Brexit. The common law principles of agency, albeit that they were developed by English courts, we need to also consider that there are important aspects of agency law and practice which are derived from the EU. Mm. So in accordance with the European Union Withdrawal Act, the regulations which we talked about at the opening of this podcast will remain in force immediately after Brexit, but on a different constitutional basis. After that, there might well be pressure to withdraw the regulations from a government whose strategy may not extend to, or whose strategy will probably extend to, more free market principles and policies. So the regulations could be regarded by some as overprotective of agents. Hmm. And such a course, I guess, would be consistent with the Brexit referendum result. But a government might decide to consider that any course of action with such drastic consequences could be delayed until issues have been reviewed in the same way as any change would be in UK law. And in particular, so that UK agency businesses have the opportunity to make representations to the government before such changes are made. The regulations would therefore probably continue to be effective under English law until Parliament decides whether protection for commercial agents should be abolished entirely or whether some modified form of protection should be granted. And as with all things like this, you know, going through government, this could take an incredibly long period of time. We can't really guess how long that might be. If after Brexit, the UK continues to be part of the European Economic Area as a member of EFTA, a course which the government has so far actually ruled out, it would seem to be that the steps would need to be taken so that the directive continues to be implemented within the UK.
Okay, brilliant. All right, thanks very much for that. It's really clear, very helpful. And I'm not going to mention Brexit again now for the rest of the podcast. Well, hopefully for the rest of the time that we're talking about Brexit. What we're going to do now, Jonathan, I mean, that's a fantastic introduction and some really good, some value-add information there. So thank you very much. But we're going to move on to some member questions, if that's okay for you now. Our first question is from Adam Neves, who is the charter manager from the operator Gamma. And Adam's looking for thoughts on this kind of from a GDPR client confidentiality standing. He says that the Gamma broker alert system that they've now officially started is aiding brokers to become aware of the following situations. Number one, whether the client that they've introduced by the that's been introduced to them by the broker has open discussions with Gamma on buying an aircraft, for example. Number two, whether the client has asked Gamma for direct contact details of the Gamma team. And number three, the client has opened discussions on specific financial transactions or sort of intentions of jet cards or different commercial options. So these clients obviously were introduced by brokers to Gamma, and Gamma are saying, and Adam's saying that obviously Gamma's mission is to ensure that the brokers are armed with all that information possible, and they're trying to be transparent as, you know, in terms of the relationship and also things like catering, likes and dislikes, and of course how to secure the client relationship and how secure that actually is. Such events are going to be communicated through an end of flight report, which they'll issue, and that's relayed to the broker within 24 hours of the flight completion. Now, Adam's saying, yeah, there are wider implications in Gamma's charter contracts, terms and conditions, because they refer to client confidentiality and GDPR compliance. So how does that new system possibly sit with that? And do you see any sort of conflicts with that and sort of GDPR against what they've already got in their contract?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. And, you know, GDPR is something that was, you know, has been a hot topic for quite a long time now. And obviously, the regulations are now in force. So companies need to be incredibly aware of how they hold, process and use their customers' data. You know, I mean, GDPR affects every company. And the hardest hit really are those that do process large amounts of data. And this will obviously include brokers and operators. But I think the main point to stress is the word consent. Consent to use process data, has to be explicit and informed. And also, if the way in which someone's data is used changes, then that person has to be informed of those changes. I suppose, you know, to be more specific to the context in which, you know, we're talking about here with, you know, Gamma and its customers or its passengers, you know, many of those people, in fact, I'd probably say all of those people are invariably going to consider their privacy to be incredibly important to them. Mm. So I would just say, look, don't attempt to use personal data unless you're doing so on a lawful basis, as detailed in the regulations, or unless you've received the unambiguous and individualized, so named affirmation of consent from the person whose data that belongs to.
And I suppose it also comes down to what GDPR consent the broker has gained from the customer, because I suppose technically, depending on how it's contracted, if the broker is contracting with Gamma, but the client or the passenger as such is then not maybe deemed the client as such, they're deemed the passenger. So effectively the broker is passing third party information on or passing the client's the passenger's information to a third party, I suppose. So again, I guess it sort of comes down to what the contract relationship is between Gamma, the broker, and the client stroke passenger, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, obviously within those agreements, there's going to be information which is, you know, sort of names, date of birthing, which is obviously considered, you know, highly sensitive information.
Yeah.
At the other end of the spectrum, we're dealing with information being passed on with regards to their likes and dislikes when on board a charter flight. So you mentioned, you know, choice of meal, that kind of thing. I mean, I think that just the overall comment I would have here is to just tread very, very carefully. And I'm sure that, you know, a company of the standing of Gamma will have taken very careful advice on this, so that hopefully the issues or the concerns raised by the question have been thought of already. But essentially, if unsure, take advice from someone who can look at it very closely and advise you as to exactly how that information can be held and used.
Sure. And as we said, you know, I suppose there's lots of different connotations to that and different scenarios depending on how the contract's set up and who they're contracting with, all that sort of stuff. So best thing to actually 100% clarify with somebody that can give you that advice. So
yeah,
excellent. Good. So Adam, I hope that answers your question, and I hope that helps. Next question we have is from Matthew Savage, who is the commercial director of the UK broking company Smart Aviation, and this is more in relation to employment of staff and subject that comes up quite a bit, and how broking businesses approach or treat non-compete clause. Matthew's asked, what are the pitfalls for members with employment contracts when a broker moves from one company to another? What are the do's and don'ts, and what is actually enforceable in terms of a non-compete clause, etc.? And also Matthew goes on to say that in an ideal world, all ACA members would need to agree employment contract, so a broker leaving one member for another or vice versa would always be subject to some standard terms of non-compete that could be devised and harmonized by the association. And he's also suggesting maybe the association could act as an intermediary and arbiter in the event of disputes to avoid hefty legal costs. And with regards to that and the ACA introducing some form of standard non-compete term, and that the ACA could act as an arbiter, is, I think, is a really interesting idea, actually, and probably more of a question for our Ask the Council feature, which we'll be holding very soon. But Jonathan, from a legal standpoint on the do's and don'ts and how enforceable is a non-compete clause, can you give us any clarity on those?
Yeah, I mean, just to go back, I mean, I think in terms of having a standardised definition, that shouldn't be too difficult, really, because, you know, there's the way in which, you know, the enforceability or not of a restrictive covenant clause or post-termination restrictions on an employee, you know, as a general rule of thumb, the starting point for a post-termination restriction is that it's void on the grounds it's a restraint of trade and therefore contrary to public policy. So based on that, really, it follows that an employer will not generally be entitled to protect himself against competition from ex-employees. That said, if an ex-employer or former employer can convince a court that such covenant within an employment contract is designed to protect their legitimate business interests, and that it extends no further than is reasonably necessary to protect those interests, then it's likely that the court would uphold and enforce the terms of that covenant. So I think it's as long as the clause is drafted fairly and appropriately, then a former employer should be protected. So, you know, for example, as mentioned, just make sure that it's there to protect legitimate business interests. So that's client connections or confidential information, not just simply there to stifle or prevent competition from the new employer.
Right. And is there anything in regards to the non-compete? I mean, I was always taught that, you know, within the non-compete or within a non-compete clause within an employment contract, potentially, if it's not worded correctly, could be null and void once the employment contracts becomes null and void. So I presume, you know, is there anything specific in terms of wording or anything like that that you would want to make sure that that is still in force, even though the actual employment contract is no longer in force?
Well, I think with many commercial contracts, I mean, it's possible to say that the specific clauses within the agreement continue despite the termination. So, for example, that would be a very common with confidentiality clauses within an agreement. So yes, not being an employment lawyer myself, I believe that should be possible. But again, it's one of these areas where if you want to be sure, and not wishing to pass the buck, but if you want to be sure, it's always best to get someone to look at these things, because you do have to be careful. You don't want to think that you've got an agreement which is legally binding to have it challenged and find that it's not something that the courts would uphold or enforce. So if in doubt, it's always good just to get a second pair of eyes on something.
Yeah, checked out. Okay, great. So Matthew, I hope that answers your question. And our next question is from Emmerich Sigar, who's the CEO of the Swiss charter company and the private jet platform Lunajets. Emmerich asks, who is legally responsible for paying de-icing fees on positioning flights, knowing that the client won't? I guess the typical scenario here is that, you know, a client contracts a flight in, I don't know, say November from somewhere like Las Palmas, where the climate is pretty mild, and therefore probably not even a consideration that the client would think of any form of de-icing is needed. But obviously for their departure out of Las Palmas, there isn't any need. However, the aircraft's not based in Las Palmas. It might be positioning from, say, Kiev, where in November has obviously a high chance of needing de-icing. So the operator cannot necessarily build that in as a contingent in the price when the flight was quoted, as, you know, maybe at that point the operator is unaware of where the aircraft's going to position in from. So if they put in de-icing in the quote, then obviously they're going to, you know, to kind of a generic de-icing price to potentially cover that, they're obviously going to be uncompetitive. But if the aircraft then ends up positioning out of Kiev to pick up the passengers in Las Palmas, the operator is obviously going to incur a hefty de-icing bill. So, you know, can they legally pass that on to the client, and can they get that client to pay?
I'm not sure I can give you any more exact answer than this, really. If a contract says that you should or you're obliged to pay for something, then you would expect that that person would therefore pay that cost. If de-icing for a positioning cost is included within the price, or it's detailed specifically as if the aircraft needs to be de-iced for positioning, you know, for its departure to pick you up, then you can put that cost onto the person that signs the agreement. But, you know, if it, in the absence of it saying that you have to pay for something, then one would assume that you won't have an obligation to do so. So I suppose, in a nutshell, if you're contractually obliged to pay for things, then you have a right to be paid accordingly. And if they're not paid, then obviously you have a legal basis to go after someone to recover those costs. I appreciate, from based on our conversations, it's a somewhat of an annoying sort of grey area for the industry. But essentially, if someone's supposed to pay for something, get it in writing and get a signature against that they have to pay for it, and then you've got something to go after them for. I hope that some way answers the question.
Sure, and I guess it comes down to, as well as a, you know, from a business point of view, if the de-icing fee is significant, is it worth going after? Obviously it is, but what are the costs associated in going after that legally, and the time and all that sort of stuff? I mean, that's maybe not the right way to look at it, but I think that's something commercially you've got to weigh up. If you're only talking, you know, a couple of thousand euros or whatever it might be, is that really enough for you to kind of take all of that time, as much as it grinds on obviously operators and having to swallow that sort of cost? And sometimes, obviously, you know, we all know, both in broking and in operating, the margins are so thin that something like that can, you know, make a flight from a positive profit point of view into a negative profit point of view. So I guess there's a commercial aspect there in terms of, you know, is it worth going after? If it's significant, then yes, then how do I go after it in the best way and legal way? So again, like you say, I suppose each case would be different in some respects.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate that that's, you know, a fairly simplistic answer, but it's, yeah, and I don't know whether looking at it the other way around, whether if you know you're going to deliver a passenger to a location where you're likely going to have to de-ice the aircraft to get it out, whether it should have been more appropriately applied to the previous flight. But that's probably not. That's probably above my pay grade to determine that.
Good. Okay. Well, that covers that one. That's great. Thanks. So, and then we have a question now from Chris Mace, who's the CEO of Dominus Aviation, and Chris asks, should a broker reveal who the operator is in a typical charter contract to their client? If so, are there any legal benefits in doing that? And in the event of liability claims as a result of the contract default by the operator?
Yeah, I mean, in answering this question, we need to look at the differences between a disclosed principle and an undisclosed principle. So a principle is said to be a disclosed principle where a customer or a client or passenger is aware that the agent is acting on behalf of another person. So a disclosed principle is either an identified person, meaning that that everyone knows the identity of the person that he's contracting with at the time the contract is made. And an unidentified principle means a third party knows the agent is acting on behalf of another person, but doesn't know the identity of that person. Right. However, you know, identification could, if necessary, take place at the time the contract is made. If a third party is aware that an agent is acting as an agent on behalf of an identified principal and the agent acts within the scope of his authority, then that creates direct contractual relationships between the principal and, or the, you know, say the charterer and the customer. And therefore the agent will generally not be liable on the transactions with a third party unless he agrees to be so, meaning that only the principal can sue or be sued on that contract. However, if a broker basically acts outside of the scope of their authority, and the party he's trying to contract on behalf of has not ratified his acts, then the principal won't be liable to the third party. So you definitely need to, a broker definitely needs to identify clearly the scope of his authority. Right. So then looking at the other side of the coin, the undisclosed principal, where a third party doesn't know that an agent is acting on behalf of another person because he hasn't disclosed that, the situation is obviously different, and the third party or the carrier or the operator or the passenger believes they're contracting directly with the agent. So where the fact that a broker is acting as broker is not disclosed to one of the parties or the party that it contracts with, and they think they're dealing directly with the operator, say, the general rule there is that provided the agent acts or the broker acts within the scope of their authority, both the real principal and the agent may sue or be sued on that contract. And if the principal reveals the agency relationship, so if the operator revealed the agency relationship to the passenger, then that passenger may either treat the agent with whom they've contracted as the principal or accept the true principal, say the operator. And in that case, the broker is then relieved of his obligations to the third party.
Right. So it's kind of it's the clarity, I suppose a court would look at it in terms of how clear was in this case, the client or the passenger in terms of who they were contracting with, effectively, is what we're saying there.
Yeah. So it's very important, really, that if you want, you know, if you're just literally acting as agents and looking to bring a passenger and an operator together, and you disclose that, then you should go ahead and do that because you can divest some of your liability. and you won't generally be liable to say the customer under that contract.
Okay, and just going back, sorry, Jonathan, for a second, but when you say scope of authority, was that the phrase you used? Scope of authority.
Yeah.
Are there certain things that obviously define scope of authority? Is that something that, that can be defined, or is that kind of depends on the contract or whatever? I mean, so one question I'm often asked is, if on cancellation terms, for example. So if an agent, a broker is acting as an agent, but actually they maybe change in favour of the agent, the terms such as the cancellation. So there's a greater maybe margin made if there's a cancellation than there would be than from what the operator has quoted to the broker. Is that outside of scope of authority? I suppose they're kind of changing stuff without the authority or the even knowing by the client. So is it something like that that would define the scope of authority?
Well, I think that's a complicated one to ask, because how is the scope of authority defined? So that can be by it's either because you've got an agreement together to say yes you can do this and no you can't do that, or whether it's something that you've done in the past and that the other party has accepted you're doing that. Then
right.
Through a course of dealing, you could show, well, look, this is something that I do to get the deals, to put the deals together, or whatever the case might be. So it's not quite as cut and dried as one might like it to be, perhaps.
Sure. So, I suppose maybe, in a past relationship or past contract, if the client's got a relationship with the broker and they're aware that the broker has done that in the past and then they do it on another contract, that would kind of be seen as given some authority to do that and therefore not outside of their scope. So, yeah, I suppose it depends on each individual case. So,
yeah.
Okay, go on.
I suppose you put it another way. You could technically do the same thing, but make the terms wildly different, and then it may be outside of, a scope of previous dealing. But so, as long as you're consistent, then, yeah, I think you could say, well, you have ostensible authority to make those changes.
Right. Okay. Excellent. So thanks for that. And then Chris goes on as well to ask that the contractual term that's regularly used of common carrier. Could you perhaps clarify the common carrier provision and usually found in operator's contract? Obviously, it's a generally misunderstood concept, and therefore many brokers, I think, would be interested to understand what a common carrier is and why a carrier would contract carriage with a broker specifically not as a common carrier.
Sure. Yeah. I suppose just in a nutshell, a common carrier in the sort of most general form of definition would be a carrier that holds itself out to the general public as, for example, an airline, flying passengers for an agreed fee. Whereas a private carrier is someone that's not holding themselves out necessarily to the general public, or can be selective to whom it decides to fly. So the distinction between common carriers and contract carriers, that also involves significant legal consequences in light of both common law and legislation. Common carriers, as you know, are everywhere are subject to very strict economic regulations. So a common carrier might be forbidden or maybe forbidden to charge unreasonably high rates or to engage in unjust discrimination, whereas a contract carrier can charge rates as high as they please. Obviously, I suppose it's in the sense of commercial limitations, and
sure,
they can discriminate amongst their customer base, lawfully. But, and a common carrier has to serve everyone who makes a lawful request for their services, whereas a contract carrier can select their customers. Another difference is a common carrier is liable for any loss or damage to goods carried during carriage, unless that's attributable to certain causes, whereas a contract carrier may only be liable for loss or damage caused through their negligence. Remembering, of course, that contractual clauses relieving a carrier from liability may have different effects depending on the status of the carrier as a common carrier or contract carrier. So I think hopefully that expresses some differences why, you know, why in some instances you would want to hold yourself out or not hold yourself out, why you want to contract as a common carrier versus a private carrier.
Excellent. Okay, Jonathan, that's brilliant. Really clear. Thank you very much. But, you know, we've run out of time now. We've obviously covered quite a lot, but I'm pretty sure that we'll probably be asking you back again in the future on this subject, as it's obviously a vast topic and one which we continue to cover, hopefully, for the future. So, but just before we go and just before I let you go, maybe you can let people know how they can get in touch with you, just in case they're looking to maybe procure your services for the future.
Sure, that's very kind of you to ask. My details are on the Backer Air Charter Association website. I can also be found on the firm website, so SGR, so Sierra Golf Romeo Law.com. Or if you pump my name into good old Google, Jonathan Russell at SGR. I will pop up on there, no doubt. I'm also on LinkedIn, so any of those would be good ways to get in contact. And obviously, we'd be delighted to speak to any of our members or anyone else who needs legal services, either in the UK or would like to put in touch with my colleagues in the US, who may be able to assist with anything, any local law questions over there.
Excellent. And as always, we'll put Jonathan's contact details in the show notes of this episode. So just leaves me to say a massive thank you to you, Jonathan, for giving us your time and, of course, your expertise. And I know it's proved extremely valuable to the membership. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I hope you agree that that was invaluable, having those questions answered for us, and my thanks again goes to Jonathan for giving us what would normally amount to a fairly hefty sum in fees if you were to individually ask those questions to a lawyer directly. As mentioned, we will be continuing our Ask the Expert feature, as we hope you can see the real value in having experts answer your queries, and we will be coming out soon with details on our next subject and, of course, our next expert on the feature. If there is any specific subject that you would like us to cover and find an expert to come in on the podcast and answer your questions, then please do let us know and we will do our best to set that up for you. In the meantime, we do have plans for currency exposure, GDPR, areas of fraudulent activity in the charter market, EU 261 regulation, traffic rights, airport slots, and aviation insurance. But any other topics you think would be worth us covering, then we'd love to hear from you. So after that very professional and serious session with Jonathan, we now just have time for our competition. And before we have this episode's question, it's time to announce the winner from our previous competition, where the question was, what is the two-digit aircraft registration prefix for the registry in the country Samoa? And of course, the answer was 5W, 5 whiskey. And our lucky winner that was pulled from the correct answers was Keith McKay from Woodgate Aviation in Belfast. So congratulations to you, Keith, and that free ticket to the Association's Excellence Awards lunch is yours. And we look forward to seeing you in London on the 17th of October. And now our prize moves on to a free ticket to the Association's Spring Lunch in April 2020. So to win a free ticket to the Spring Lunch, all you have to do is answer this simple question. Pretty much everyone has heard of the airline Qantas, but the word Qantas is actually an acronym. So what does Qantas actually stand for? As always, send your answers in to admin@theaircharterassociation.aero to win that free ticket. The closing date is Friday the 8th of November, so good luck to you all. It's that time again in the episode where we ask for your support to the Association's charity Fly to Help. Fly to Help does amazing work with children and adults in desperate need of some respite, be that due to terminal illness, bereavement, or profound disability. And they do this using aviation and the magic of flight to provide fantastic experiences and memories. To donate to Fly to Help, go to www.flytohelp.org/howtohelp and click the Donate Now button. And please give what you can. It really does make a difference to those who need it. So again, thank you very much for your support. So on to a quick look at our next episode, and we'll be having another special for you. It's our Excellence Awards lunch episode, and we'll be meeting many members and guests attending the lunch, and of course getting the reactions from some of the award winners. So if you are attending the Excellence Awards lunch on the 17th of October, we look forward to seeing you there. And if you can't attend, then obviously the next best thing is to catch the awards lunch special episode. So until then, fly safe and bye for now. Thank you for listening, and join us next time on the Air Charter Podcast, the industry's only dedicated podcast to the air charter industry, brought to you by the Air Charter Association.